Los Angeles.
Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a warning from Attorney General Sessions to would-be leakers, don't do it, and his threat to reporters that he is reviewing press subpoenas that would force journalists to reveal their sources or face jail time. Cora Currier, a journalist who, as a reporting fellow at ProPublica, covered national security and now covers national security and press freedom for The Intercept, joins us to discuss Sessions' response to humiliating public criticism from Trump that he was, quote, very weak on intel leakers, and the release of embarrassing transcripts of the president's private conversations with world leaders. We will examine the DOJ's pursuit of three times as many leak investigations that occurred under the Obama administration and the FBI's creation of a new unit to handle the investigations. Then we'll look into why Donald Trump holds so many campaign-style rallies in West Virginia and why the state's governor and only billionaire made an appearance at last Thursday's rally to announce that he had switched from the Democratic to the Republican Party. Bob Kincaid, the co-founder of the Appalachians Communities Health Emergency Campaign and the president of the Coal River Mountain Watch, joins us to explain Trump's popularity in a state with the nation's worst opioid addiction crisis and the highest death rate from opioids, yet is the most dependent on Medicaid funds to address the crisis as Trump plans to cut Medicaid and proposed a 95% cut in funding for the agency leading the charge against the country's opioid epidemic. Then finally, we'll assess why the United Auto Workers failed in their bid to unionize the Nissan plant in Mississippi, at which the majority of workers voted with the company against the UAW in a bitterly contested campaign. An expert on labor issues, Harley Shaken, a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, who studies labor, information technology, and the organization of work, joins us to discuss the latest defeat for labor in the right-to-work South. And joining us now is Cora Currier, who is a journalist who writes about national security, immigration, human rights, press freedom, and other topics for The Intercept. Previously, she worked as a reporting fellow at ProPublica and on the editorial staff of The New Yorker, and was a lead researcher on several books of history and politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cora Currier.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us, Cora. And this morning on Fox News, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein acknowledged that anybody who breaks the law, including White House staffers and members of Congress, could be prosecuted as the Justice Department ramps up its efforts to stop leaks following the press conference on Friday at which the Attorney General made the remarks that I mentioned in the opening. Now, while Rosenstein said, we're after leakers, not journalists, we don't prosecute journalists for doing their jobs, nevertheless, the Attorney General made it clear that they were going to ramp up press subpoenas. And they actually mentioned that there were four, or at least there was a leak, maybe it was a leak, that there were four people being investigated as we speak. So do you take any comfort from Rod Rosenstein's remarks on Fox News on Sunday?
I think there are a few things to unpack here. One is that they can talk about going after leakers as much as they want, but the fact is that not all leaks are illegal. And a lot of what the Trump administration has been sort of selectively upset about getting out into the press has very little to do with national security. It's more sort of palace intrigue, insider notes about meetings, things like that. You know, certainly some of the things that have come out about the Trump administration's since Trump took office would be marked classified and could potentially lead to charges for somebody who brought them out. But the fact is that this is the way Washington has worked for a long, long time. Sensitive information gets leaked, and unless there is a high bar to build a case that the release of information damaged national security, and that's usually what they'd have to do in order to bring charges. So, they can be investigating a lot, but whether that will actually result in charges is another question. The second thing You know, but that's not to say that this doesn't have a chilling effect on reporting, and particularly on sources, because the, you know, the rank and file people working in the government, people who normally would, you know, let reporters know how what's going on, even if, you know, they're not necessarily revealing state secrets here. They're talking about sort of day-to-day things, but they don't necessarily have authorized, you know, press hand, you know, perfectly crafted statements for the press, but they're, you know, able to discuss and let the public know what's going on. And that's incredibly important with this administration, you know, which has taken several steps backward in terms of what kind of, in terms of providing access to the public for, you know, basic information about how the government, you know, government policy. And so I think that, you know, it is alarming just the message that they're sending, particularly to government staff, you know, that they're going to be aggressively pursuing each and every leak.
Well, it's a bit ironic to think that there's so much investigation going on to whether or not the Trump campaign and the Trump administration has some kind of covert secret ties to Russia, which I think by all definitions is considered an adversary of the United States. And it doesn't seem like Putin seems to be more quite focused on what they call Glavny Protivnik, the main enemy, which is the KGB's mindset, which he certainly has from his background, about the United States. So the idea that all of this talk from the White House about fake news and Trump's talking about illegal leakers and then publicly humiliating Sessions for being very weak on intel leakers, and then again on at the announcement by the Attorney General Sessions, they talked about helping enemy adversaries, illegal leaks. They cannot place lives at risk with impunity, and the lives of those who serve in the intelligence community, the armed forces, and all law-abiding Americans. So they're making a pretty clear case, or at least they're trying to conflate what you suggested, which is most of the leaks are about who's up and who's down inside the White House. And this is a White House that, with obviously deep problems in its staffing and its morale, as opposed to, so they're trying to sort of conflate that with the idea that there's a whole bunch of treason going on, when in fact, at the end of the day, the real case about treason may well involve the president himself.
Yeah, I think there's certainly a lot of conflation happening, a lot of, you know, deliberate spreading of confusion of comparing leaks to, you know, discussions with the media, information getting out into the media with, you know, for example, cases like Harold Martin, this NSA employee who was charged with having classified information at his home and possibly, you know, giving it to foreign adversaries. You know, that's a completely different scenario, you know, an actual sort of concern about espionage. That's a completely different scenario than, you know, someone talking to The New York Times or to The Intercept. And so I think that there's, you know, definitely an attempt to sow confusion over that and just get people sort of up in a hysteria. And it's part of their narrative of you know, that the media is out to get them and the media is, you know, the enemy of the American people. And that's part of the narrative that they've been putting forward for months.
So, again, I'm speaking with Cora Currier, who's a journalist who writes about national security, immigration, human rights, press freedom, and other topics for The Intercept. And previously, she worked as a reporting fellow at ProPublica and on the editorial staff of The New Yorker, and was a lead researcher on several books of history and politics. Now, of course, The Intercept, they published the NSA report, a very recent and highly secret NSA report that was leaked to them, and I'm assuming it was the person that was arrested, reality winner, had something to do with that. So what's the feeling at The Intercept? Because some like Glenn Greenwald of The Intercept has been very skeptical of the Russian collusion with the Trump administration story. But nobody has ever suggested, as far as I know, that what The Intercept published in terms of this NSA document was in any way inaccurate. In fact, it was fairly alarming. It indicated that Russian intelligence was working very recently on looking into the voting systems in many key swing states in the American electorate.
So I can't comment at all on the Rowdy Winner case or the alleged identity of the source for that story. But we stand by our reporting on it and, think that it's, really important that if there is, further evidence of Russian collusion or impact on the election, that it, be made public.
Well, what I think we can assume, though, here, Cora, is that this young lady is going to spend a lot of time in jail for doing what she thought was important to get information out to the American people. And that's presumably the motivation for whoever leaked the transcripts of those early conversations that Donald Trump had with world leaders shortly after his administration began. The transcripts reveal a embarrassingly ill-prepared, delusional, and alarmingly ignorant president making really incoherent statements and veiled threats to world leaders. And presumably, I know this is subjective, but presumably whoever leaked that leaked it because they were concerned that we have a commander-in-chief and a president who is not up to the task.
Well, I think there's been some, there was some pushback to the leaks of those. There's a few commentators who pushed back against the leak of those transcripts, saying, that this was a sort of erosion of norms, that certain diplomacy has to happen behind closed doors, and the president should be afforded that kind of ability to make decisions in private. But I think that you're correct that it seems like this, this administration is such an outlier that those arguments really don't hold up. The public needs to know, how the president is handling these conversations with foreign leaders, especially when his own statements from day to day change radically and don't line up with his party or any party's policies. And I think that it's incredibly, that we're going to be dependent during this administration on courageous government employees and people with access to information who decide to take the risk involved in getting it out to the public.
No, indeed. I think right across the board, both conservative and liberal commentators all acknowledge that the president should have the ability to have private conversations with world leaders where some of what they say in private contradicts with what they've said in public, but that's how business gets done. But I think what I'm suggesting, I think what you're agreeing to is that this is a different White House, a different president, and certainly we've had an unprecedented amount of leaks, have we not, from this White House. There's something going on there, surely, that indicates disarray. I think the word chaos is being used a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is an indication that we need, that this is just not business as usual, and that people are responding with as much, whatever they can, however they can, try to better inform the public and sort of balance the way this administration is acting.
So let's just turn to what we know. We don't know who the four people that the Justice Department are looking at. They're certainly not journalists, as far as I know. And is that the case with you, Cora, that we don't know of any journalists that are being investigated, but there's supposedly four people investigated. And Rod Rosenstein acknowledged that there are three times as many investigations going on now as they were during the Obama administration, and also acknowledged that there's a new FBI unit looking into these investigations. So what do you know beyond that?
Well, I think that we have to take into account that it's possible that they're very likely they're looking at journalists themselves for prosecution, but when they talk about subpoenaing journalists, this is a reference to a change that occurred during the Obama administration where the Attorney General Eric Holder walked back Justice Department's ability to subpoena reporters in order to obtain information on their sources. And this was after it was revealed that they had issued these very wide-ranging subpoenas to get phone records from the Associated Press in one case, that they had labeled Fox News reporter James Rosen as an unindicted co-conspirator in another leak investigation. And this was, they had used those tools in order to get information, you know, in order to get access to the journalist's communication with sources. And that was, you know, those, when that came out that they had done that, that was widely criticized. You know, this is, again, in the context of the Obama administration bringing, you know, more Espionage Act prosecutions than any other administration in history. And so there was a big pushback on that. In 2013, they revised those guidelines, or 2014, excuse me, and made it more difficult, or basically made it such that it was a last resort in order to subpoena journalists. And they, you know, put in place a number of other sort of protections about going after journalists' records. There were still loopholes. For instance, it appears that they could use national security letters, which are sort of secret requests for metadata for basically who called, you know, basic subscriber information and details about when and to whom calls were placed. They can use those with fewer sign-offs, and they don't have to, you know, inform the news organization that they're using those. So there were still loopholes, but basically there was sort of a pendulum swing back. Like the Obama administration pulled in some of its aggressive targeting of journalists in order to obtain their sources. This may be a pendulum swing in the other direction. And if there are, you know, I think you could expect to see a, you know, journalists really taking a stand and refusing to turn over records. News organizations, mm-hmm. you know, already, I think, are prepared to resist this, you know, any kind of demands for information. So it could end up in some really arduous court battles.
Well, just in closing, of course, the Obama administration also went after the New York Times reporter James Risen, and they also, Obama pardoned I think it was the deputy national security advisor, a high-ranking general, who was accused of leaking the existence of the Stuxnet, who was behind the Stuxnet virus that infected the Iranian nuclear program. So that would indicate again, which is really the bottom line, surely, here, Cora, and that is that most of the leaks come from the government itself, right? I mean, not prior to this bizarre White House we have now, but that's been the norm, hasn't it? That the government itself does control leaking more than do unauthorized leaking.
Certainly, I think that the cases that, you know, we think of when there's, you know, a sort of whistleblower coming forward and giving information or documents being leaked, you know, those, yeah, certainly that is. You know, the exception to the norm, which is, you know, the way that Washington reporting has happened for decades, which is, you know, a lot of conversations between high-ranking officials and the press, and they're putting forward, you know, the interpretation and the information that they want out. And you know, that's not all bad. You know, we need that information as well, even if, you know, so yes, certainly there's, you know, it's long been the case that there are unauthorized leaks, and then there are what are known as authorized leaks as well.
Well, Cora Carrier, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Cora Carrier, who's a journalist who writes about national security, immigration, human rights, press freedom, and other topics for The Intercept. Previously, she worked as a reporting fellow at ProPublica and on the editorial staff of The New Yorker, and was a lead researcher on several books of history and politics. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into why Donald Trump holds so many campaign-style rallies in West Virginia.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real. But it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Bob Kincaid, the co-founder of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign and president of the Coal River Mountain Watch. He's the founder of the Head On Radio Network, on which he's a regular host. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bob Kincaid.
Well, thank you very kindly, Ian. It's always nice to talk with you.
Well, thank you, Bob. And well, let's answer that question, which is, why does Donald Trump keep going to West Virginia? What is it?
Because if you remember many, many years ago, they used to describe Disneyland as the happiest place on earth. Well, West Virginia is the Trumpiest place on earth. And as a consequence, with his poll numbers in the sewer all over the country, well, they're still pretty high in West Virginia, and West Virginians are still pretty high on Donald Trump.
But, for example, West Virginia has the nation's worst opioid addiction crisis and the highest death rate from opioids, and yet it is the most dependent upon Medicaid funds to address this crisis. And Trump plans to cut Medicaid, as we've known, and he's also had proposed a 95% cut in funding for the agency leading the charge against the country's opioid epidemic. So how do you reconcile those two things? You've got a terrible opioid addiction problem, and most of the treatment is coming through Medicaid, and there's just no secret of the fact that Trump is completely cavalier about cutting Medicaid in these various Republican bills that mercifully didn't pass.
Well, what you didn't mention in that list, Ian, and no offense, is coal, okay? Coal occupies a status in West Virginia that approaches that of a fetishized object of religious adoration. So the thing that matters most to the Trump voter is that he promises them that he's going to bring back coal, because, gosh, if coal comes back, nobody will need Medicaid because we're all going to have jobs digging coal, okay? I mean, that's absurd, it's insane, but it is also the mindset, okay? And look, with a whole bunch of, you know, there are a bunch of people who are on opioids, there are people who are addicted, there are people who overdose, and who knows how many of those vote for Trump, okay? We're talking about one of the most singularly dysfunctional states in the union, and I don't say that as some sort of outside criticizer. I'm ninth generation or more West Virginian, so I'm talking about the place that is, you know, all of my origins. But it's also, but I also have to recognize its reality, and people responded to Trump in part because they were voting against the Democratic nominee, but that doesn't explain all of it. It's a matter of him speaking to their fetish object. He venerated their fetish object, and consequently, they venerate him.
Well, he made a photo op out of having this rather corpulent fellow who's the richest man in West Virginia, the governor, Jim Justice, sort of shamble onto the stage to announce that he's no longer a Democrat and is now a Republican. I mean, if he's a billionaire, I'm not sure that he represents the 99%. But maybe I'm unfair. What's going on there? Why did this guy have that photo op, and why did he make this switch?
Well, for Jim Justice, with the atmosphere around Trump as it is, it does him no harm to become a Republican. But I submit that this was his plan long before Trump was elected president, because, you see, Jim Justice stood on that stage and talked about how his old dear sainted mama would have said, "Jimmy, what took you so long to become a Republican?" And that was just a bunch of hogwash, Ian. He'd been a Republican as recently as 2015, okay? This isn't some sea change. This isn't a difference between night and dark. This is a dog returning to its vomit, okay?
Well, I'm trying to digest that remark. What's going on there with Jim Justice and the Russians? One of the extraordinary things about this Trump administration is that everything seems to go back to Russia. I mean, we were talking about in the segment before this on what's going on at the Department of Justice. And now, of course, the person that the Trump administration have put up to be the head of the criminal division of the Justice Department, which is a very important part of the Justice Department, it turns out that his former client was the Alpha Bank, which is a big Russian bank with ties to the Kremlin. So you can't sort of escape Russia. But what's the connection between Governor Jim Justice, the billionaire, the richest man in West Virginia, his money comes from coal, I believe, and what's going on with him and the Russians? He apparently made a lot of money out of them, and are they suing him? What's going on?
Well, what happened? Let's understand first. Jim Justice made his money the old-fashioned way. He inherited it. He's in agriculture. He's in coal. He owns the Greenbrier Resort. But back in 2009, when coal was in the middle of one of its, and quite possibly its final boom phase, and international coal prices were through the roof, Jim Justice sold off a bunch of the coal mines that he had inherited from his daddy, who did all the heavy lifting. He sold it off to a Russian company called Mechel, M-E-C-H-E-L, and he sold it for some ungodly amount of money, north of $500 million. Well, then the bottom fell out of the coal industry. Coal became almost without value, and he turned around and looked back at Mechel and said, "Well, you fellas seem to be in some hard straits. What do you say I buy that back from you for $5 million?
$5 million? From $500 million, yes, to $5 million?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that good old boy knows how to make a deal, right?
Yeah, and then it's something straight. It's like a story out of Green Acres where the country bumpkin takes advantage of the city slicker or whatever. That's the way it's portrayed. And then he turns around and he makes a big PR splash out of the fact that he put 200 coal miners back to work. But you also have to remember at the same time that he has been referred to in the recent past as America's most dangerous coal mine owner. And that's saying something in a world that has people like Bob Murray and Don Blankenship in it, okay? He is a scofflaw with regard to his mine's adherence to Mine Safety and Health Administration regulations. He is notorious for shorting and stiffing his suppliers and not paying his taxes on time or sometimes at all. And consequently, it's sort of, you were asking, you know, why would Trump go to West Virginia, or why would this guy flip and become a Republican governor? Well, golly Moses, they're two peas in a pod, Trump and Justice. The real people who have egg on their face out of this are folks like the Democratic Governors Association that spent millions of dollars to elect this guy, when anybody they asked in West Virginia could have told him, this guy's about as much a Democrat as I'm the galactic overlord from Norblap 9, okay? In other words, not at all. And so consequently, they look silly. The West Virginia Democratic Party, which has in recent years become nothing more than a cult of personality for Joe Manchin, looks downright stupid.
And again, I'm speaking with Bob Kincaid, the co-founder of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign and the president of the Coal River Mountain Watch. And he's also the founder of the Head On Radio Network, on which he's a regular host. So I was looking at the faces of the behind Donald Trump at this rally on Thursday in West Virginia with a raucous adoration. And, you know, then, of course, he talks about his amazing electoral victory, and it's like Groundhog Day. It just keeps going back to the campaign, and it's very bizarre in general. But I was sort of trying to focus on the people and behind him, and they were in ecstasy. Most of all, when he again goes after Hillary Clinton, who certainly didn't help herself by basically giving coal miners the back of the hand, saying, you know, you guys are all, you know, roadkill. She did mention we're going to figure out some way to transition to you to other jobs, but that apparently hurt her a lot, whereas Trump is embracing coal at the expense, I might say, of dealing with global warming and leaving America in the dust as China and even India take over solar and wind and move into the 21st century, leaving America behind. So there's a surreal quality to it, but when he went after Hillary for the umpteenth time, lock her up became the chant. I mean, what is it? Where is that passion coming from? Why is he able to ignite it? What is the hatred there of Hillary?
Well, you have to come back to the fetishization of coal again, Ian, because West Virginians didn't hear the entirety of that remark about a lot of coal workers are going to be out of work, or a lot of miners are going to be out of work. But that's all they heard. They didn't hear the part about we've got to help those people. They didn't hear the part about the fact that she had at least a compassionate transition plan to try to plan for the day when coal is no longer dominant in West Virginia. And, of course, coal is no longer dominant in West Virginia. It is not the mass engine of economic development. It's not an engine of employment anymore, okay? Then, back and forth, Walmart and healthcare go back and forth as the number one and number two employers in West Virginia. Coal is nowhere to be found, okay? It becomes more insignificant every day in terms of human employment because of mechanization, all right? The days of full employment from coal are over, but it remains a religious fetish object. It's something that's venerated. It's as if West Virginians walk around fingering little rosaries made out of coal, okay? It's not related to reality. It's not related to rational thought. But you talk about the crowd in Huntington last week. There was one guy there that he was immediately over what would have been Trump's left shoulder. The guy looked like he was on the verge of rolling on the floor and speaking in tongues and handling serpents, okay? He was completely losing it. I have since been told, Ian, that guy's a millionaire.
I think I saw that fellow, with the blue cap and... Yeah, I mean, that's what I was trying to get from you. What is that ecstasy?
It's the ecstasy of vengeance. It's the ecstasy of finally getting even. Because you have to remember, Hillary Clinton was tied to Barack Obama. And West Virginia is, by at least one metric, the single most racist state in the union. Okay? So... For years now, and I think you and I have even talked about it in the past, West Virginia was inundated with this message of the Obama war on coal. And, of course, you've got to tie in with the fetish object with an object of absolute hatred. In other words, a black president. And, of course, Hillary worked for him. So, you know, there were lots of ads in the last election about, you know, Hillary's going to continue the disastrous policies of Barack Obama. And so this religious ecstasy is the notion that somehow or another, even though he is wildly different from the average West Virginian, that he has this identifiable, majestic whiteness that they can finally identify with.
I think it's more like an orangeness, but I get your point. What then explains, though, I mean, you don't have to be an amateur psychiatrist to figure out there's a connection between the loss of work, the loss of status, the economic dislocation as coal becomes irrelevant. And by the way, coal is being killed on Wall Street, not by Obama or Hillary Clinton.
No, it's being killed by fracking.
And fracking and the gas shale gas boom. But clearly there's a connection with the fact that the state's got the highest opioid addiction rate and death rate from opioids. That's not a hard leap to connect. But then what explains, and I believe Shelley Moore Caputo did try to weigh in on these various repeal and replace bills that the Republicans were struggling with to try and put some money in there and to save the cuts on Medicaid, or at least to offset the cuts on Medicaid. They think they wanted an offset of $45 billion, which would be very inadequate in any case against these cuts on Medicaid, because most of the West Virginians with opioid addiction problems are treated under Medicaid. And as I mentioned, you know, in the Trump budget, they also planned on cutting 95% of the Office of Drug Control, which is the lead agency dealing with the opioid addiction. So there's no question in my mind that, you know, Trump is speaking with a forked tongue here. On the one hand, he's, you know, I mean, well, let me ask you this. Why is that connection not made, that the guy that they idolize is going to cut the means by which they get treated for opioid addiction?
They don't care. They don't care. You see, it's one of those weird things about privilege and prejudice. If you need help, then you deserve the help. But if your neighbor over there needs help, well, you know, those people, that family's always been that way. Okay, it's a very tribal thing. But you mentioned Shelley Moore Capito. And I want to be careful that we do not in any wise lionize her for saying that she wanted some money for addiction treatment, because in the end, she is her father's daughter. Her dad was the single most corrupt man ever to be governor of West Virginia. This is the guy who, when a giant sludge dam collapsed in 1972 and wiped out lives and communities, he was among the first to run out and say, well, obviously, this was an act of God, you know, not an act of his coal company patron who had negligently maintained the dam and gotten a bunch of people killed. So it's not at all surprising that she might give a little lip service, but in the end, she'll do what a Moore always does to West Virginians, and that is, if they don't have a bunch of money, screw them over. So, you know, the answer to your question, I think, is one, Ian, of somebody somehow has got to have a serious conversation with Appalachia. I try to have that conversation 5 nights a week. I kid, I carry on, I clown around. But there are real questions that have to be answered. One of them is our self-esteem so low that the only thing we think we're good for is to be killed by an industry that's been killing us for 150 years? Is that all there is to us? Are we not good enough to have the kind of wages that other successful areas of the country have? And then there's the larger question for the rest of the country. Appalachia cannot solve its own problems. Appalachia is going to have to be treated like a part of the United States by the rest of the country. And frankly, we're not.
But why then, is this some form of the Stockholm Syndrome where you identify with your torturer? Why turn to people like Shelley Moore Caputo from this corrupt lineage? And why turn to this Jim Justice character who's the state's richest man, the state's only billionaire? And you, as you say, he's got the worst record as a coal mine owner.
Because there's meaningfully no... The Democratic Party, especially since Joe Manchin got hold of it, Ian, has become a moribund shade of its former self. We don't run real Democrats. We run Republican light. And that strategy has gotten the Democrats absolutely flattened for more than 10 years now. Mm. Okay? When Shelley Moore Capito ran for Senate, her Democratic opponent... She tried to out-worship coal, and she couldn't do it.
Mm.
Okay? I mean, Elizabeth Warren came down and campaigned for her, for pity's sake. But you cannot win an office in the modern era saying, well, I'm just a little bit different from my opponent. There's no meaningful choice taking place in November.
Wow. Well, it's certainly a distant memory, isn't it, when Bobby Kennedy was in West Virginia and was, you know, treated like a messiah, like a savior. Yeah.
If you've got just 1 second, Ian, let me add in one thing. In all of this Jim Justice flipping to Republican business, I want to make one thing clear. his opponent in 2016 was a ruthless Republican millionaire, a guy who said that if you make $50,000 a year, you make an unfairly high wage. He was the Senate president at the time, a guy named Bill Cole. Had he been elected governor, whatever the legislature did in the previous session would have been 50 times worse, because they would have rammed through one of those typical right-wing, ultra-conservative agendas, and they would not have had any problem doing it. So to that extent, even though he's switching to be a Republican, and even though I don't much care for him, I do acknowledge that things could have been worse. We've still got expanded Medicaid, for instance. Had Bill Cole been the governor, he and the Republican majority legislature would have immediately taken that away.
Mm. Well, Bob Kincaid, I thank you for joining us. We've run out of time, but I appreciate you joining us, and let's stay in touch.
Anytime. It's always a pleasure, Ian.
Well, thank you, Bob. And again, I've been speaking with Bob Kincaid, who's the co-founder of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign and the president of the Coal River Mountain Watch and the founder of Head On Radio Network, on which he's a regular host. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back assessing why the United Auto Workers failed in their bid to unionize the Nissan plant in Mississippi. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Harley Shaken, who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, and the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Harley Shaken.
It's nice to be here.
Well, thank you, Harley. And what do you make of the fact that roughly the 3,500 employees of the Canton-based plant down there in Mississippi, the Nissan plant, opposed the unionization? I don't know whether it was a majority, but an awful lot of these workers were African-American. The vote was pretty substantially in favor of the company over the United Auto Workers. Not 2-1, but I think about over 60% voted not to unionize. So I'm trying to sort of figure out, is this the sort of mindset of the right-to-work states in the South? Is this a case of the government, as the UAW has accused them, of using unfair leverage and practices and coercion? Or what is it? What's your analysis, Holly?
I think it was a historic vote at the Nissan plant in Canton. And in fact, while it was a defeat in the vote, the organizing drive is far from over, and it does signal that it could well be possible to organize major manufacturing facilities and other workplaces in the South. What happened here had two dimensions to it. The UAW did get about 38% of the vote. Well, you might say that's a long way from victory, except two factors went into it. There's actually a total of about 6,400 workers in the plant. 2,700, over 40%, are temporary workers that work for Kelly, a temp agency. They were workers who were the most sympathetic to joining a union. They couldn't vote. They start at $13 an hour and they have no defined progression to ever become permanent. That was one factor. The second factor of about the 3,800 or so permanent workers in the plant, the UAW did get 38% of the vote, but Nissan ran a very well-financed, hardball campaign that created a climate of fear and intimidation that materially affected the vote. Now, it's one thing simply to say that. The regional director of the National Labor Relations Board concurred with the dimension of that and issued a complaint. And in fact, the eve of the vote, the United Auto Workers filed 7 additional complaints, and the election has not yet been certified because of employer interference. Nissan went up to the line of what's legal and absolutely crossed over it in terms of creating this climate of fear. So for many of the permanent workers, they were voting implicitly, not whether or not they wanted a union, but the way Nissan made them feel, vote for a union and possibly lose your job. That's a very different kind of election.
And you, as you pointed out, that even though the full-time employees, the roughly 3,500, can make up to $26 per hour, which is certainly high in Mississippi, the most of the workers are non-unionized and are do part-time through a part-time employment agency where they get no benefits and their wages are, what, half of that, around $13 an hour. Is that what
they start at 13? Absolutely.
Yeah. So there's the real story there, right?
Oh, without question. And Nissan created a narrative that, look at Detroit. It collapsed because of the UAW. What they neglected to mention in that is last year, UAW General Motors workers got profit-sharing checks of $12,000 each. That's in addition to senior wages of $29. You have starting workers at UAW plants in Detroit that start at $19 an hour, but there's a clear progression over 8 years to the senior wage, and they still get that profit sharing. At Nissan, there is no progression. And Nissan does give a bonus check akin to profit sharing last year, $4,000. So you're comparing $4,000 to $12,000 just in that dimension.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Holly Shaken, who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, where he studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. So how does this look in terms of previous attempts in the South, in the Right to Work South? And I might add that, you know, that with the addition of Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court, who is extremely anti-labor, a real corporatist, as most of them are, majority, and frankly, that is never ever talked about in these confirmation hearings of justices. They always ask them about their position on abortion, but they never ask their position on labor and corporatism versus labor issues. And you know, we're very close to the Supreme Court looking at a case out of California that could basically kill off the public sector unions. So you've got people like the Koch brothers on this jihad against unions, and they seem to have been making some progress. In 2014, the UAW narrowly lost an organization campaigned at the Volkswagen facility in Tennessee. And then this year, Boeing workers in South Carolina rejected a union unionization plan by a 3-to-1 margin. That was a different union, the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. So what are we to make from those the defeats now, added to which we had this defeat at the Nissan plant in Mississippi?
Well, the Volkswagen was almost a success. So I wouldn't quite write that off as a defeat, a sharp setback. It wasn't good news, but not the kind of defeat that we've seen in the past. And I would say the same thing about Nissan as well. Here's why. At Nissan, the workforce is overwhelmingly African-American. The UAW created in the plant, working with very committed workers, a social movement and a social movement outside of the plant. So you had civil rights organizations, you had community groups, you had churches, you had people in the community really supporting this. Now, they suffered a defeat. They got 38% of the vote, but they laid the basis for coming back in the future. The spirit of the people who were very involved with the campaign is, of course, you know, they're upset that they didn't win, but they have a sense of redoubling their efforts going forward. Nissan made a lot of promises. Now they're going to have to fulfill those promises, or very likely in a year or two be subject to another campaign. So this didn't end any more than social movements in the past ended even after very sharp defeats. And I think you can look back at Martin Luther King Jr. in Memphis marching with striking sanitation workers on the last days of his life, or Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez in the fields of California in the 60s and 70s, and really see that there have been, even after initial defeats, some important successes that take place.
Well, given that the Nissan behaved so badly, and they had put up this big tent in front of the plant, and they made all of the employees sit down and get kind of lectured like school kids and shamed, and they put up billboards all around town. They used all the local media, and they basically threatened that they'd leave town altogether. You know, it was either you either vote against the UAW or we, you know, leave town and you're all out of work. It was a very dishonest and nasty campaign. Senator Bernie Sanders weighed in against them and was outraged at their behavior. Could this lead to some kind of consumer boycott of Nissan cars?
It could, but I think that what's ultimately going to decide this is the strategy on the ground. And here, things aren't going to get easier. They're going to get more difficult given the Supreme Court, politics, et cetera. But nonetheless, what happened here makes me optimistic that this story is far from over, because you've got a very committed group in the plant, you've got a very committed group in the community, and I think they've learned a lot from this campaign that they will employ in future efforts here. Nissan came up with some things that really did break new ground in a very unfortunate way. They threatened that the whole plant might leave because it would no longer be a competitive place. That's been done before, but here they said, well, you know, if the UAW comes in and you have a strike, we can't guarantee you're going to have a job after a strike. That's a new twist, and really is a very direct threat. Workers have some leases on favorable terms when they buy a Nissan car. They created the rumor that that would all disappear if the UAW wins. You can't do that in an election, but Nissan absolutely did it. So for fair-minded people, they created a climate of fear. And you want to have your job. You don't want to lose your job. But that led many, likely, the margin of victory to vote against the UAW. The status quo may not be good, but the future was one of fear, and that carried the day. Today, But what happens in the future remains an open question. I'm not looking at it with rose-colored glasses, but I think there are legitimate reasons to think that this could not be the end of the story.
So this is a, you don't think then in the broader context that having the Koch brothers essentially own the House and possibly the Senate, they certainly, if you look at all the only, you know, Trump has achieved very, very little, except a lot in terms of changing regulations. And if you look at the scoreboard for what the House has passed and what the Trump administration have achieved, it's all basically the Koch brothers' agenda, getting out of the Paris Accords, crippling the EPA, opening up the tar sands pipelines from Canada, opening up offshore drilling, etc. These are all, this is all the Koch brothers' agenda. So I don't think one is particularly cynical to suggest that our House and Senate are pretty much sold out to the Kochs, and I don't know the extent to which they control the White House. If they don't, the Mercer family does. So we're talking about plutocratic control of our politics, which I think is manifestly clear. So in the overall battle between plutocracy and democracy, labor, of course, is a big component, if not the yardstick by which we can judge whether people are going to survive, a middle-class standard of living is going to survive. So put it in that context for us, if you will, in closing, the larger battle, if you will.
Oh, I think you really pointed to the most central dimension. Ultimately, we're not talking about a fight at a Nissan plant in Canton or a UAW story or an auto story. We're talking about the role of unions in any democracy, and at this moment, the role of those forces that absolutely want to address issues of climate change, that want to build a middle-class society, that want to engage all the dimensions of what we have to do going forward. If unions are unable to organize or continue to unravel, it becomes impossible to do that. And if they can be strengthened, and if an organizing drive begins to succeed going forward, then it has much broader political implications on some of the defining issues we face, not simply the United States, but the world, in which the United States plays such an outside role on an issue like climate change or some of the other things that you mentioned.
So just in the last few seconds, the Koch brothers are winning, but they may be winning the battles, but they're not going to win the war. What's it going to take?
Absolutely, a number of lost battles. But if you look at the battles carefully, there are important signs of hope, more than hope, of the ability to fight harder and more effectively, and succeed in the future. Even though the opposition will get stronger, that doesn't describe the end of the story.
Well, Dr. Holly Shaken, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Holly Shaken, who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.